I'm still actually a little in shock that this actually happened and you guys are here. To be honest,
I think we are too.
Yeah.
how did this happen?
I don't know.
Are you talking a broader picture, or why specifically we're doing this LA show tonight?
How did the Gories come back together?
Well, one thing is we knew that there's still interest in the band because people would always bug us individually about, like, when are you guys going to get back together? I never got to see you guys. I know Peggy's gotten it in New Orleans, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
definitely. Replies were usually never and too bad.
But then Crypt Records, Tim Warren, was going to have a 25th anniversary because I think he started in 83, so what mm-hmm. would make that?
2008?
Yeah, so he was going to have a 25th anniversary and party, and he wanted us to play, and we're like, we talked to each other about it, and we're like, well, do you want to do it? And we're like, yeah. Mick was like, I'll
do it. We hemmed and hawed, and I had an outrageous demand, which was never met, so.
Yeah.
Well, and he was like, well, we should just do it and not
not tell anybody that we were going to be there.
Brilliant.
Well, I was on vacation, and I didn't want to interrupt it. I know that's why I didn't want to. It's one of the reasons I didn't want to play that. There's other
But he
ones
also
too.
Approached the Oblivions about it.
Right.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And Peggy was talking to Eric.
Yeah, I was talking to Eric Friedel on the phone, and he asked if we were playing it, and I asked if they were playing it, and he said, well, I think we should just have a show with just us two. Hmm. And right. And I said, yeah, that's a good idea, but I don't want to get back together and practice and everything for one show. So if we do it, I want it to be more than one show, you know, mm-hmm. like quite a bit more. So then we
and
just talked about it.
And after much browbeating, I said, okay.
Yeah, we talked with those guys about it, and we started getting kind of excited about the idea of doing a tour together. And you know, Greg was saying, well, you know, I've got this really good manager booking agent over in Europe that could put together a really good tour, and she's great at it. And just started looking like a good idea because those guys got really excited about it, too.
You know? Yeah, and we're friends with them, so it made it a lot. It made it more appealing knowing that we'd be going on tour with friends of ours,
you know,
as opposed to, you know, some, you know, band we don't really know that well.
Yeah, I mean, it makes good sense, I guess, in a couple ways. One, you know, just because it'd been some time since you guys have been out playing. Oh, the thing I was wondering is whether or not it'd been some time before all you'd been together, kind of in the same room or even making music together or anything like that.
Well, after about 2001, 2009?
What?
After you married Dan.
Oh, what happened after I married Dan? Oh, when did I marry
him? Yeah, when you married, after Peggy married a friend of ours.
2004.
2004, mm-hmm. We started being in more rooms at the same time.
That's true.
Because Peggy married this guy who's from Detroit, and he was like one of the first Gories fans. You know, one of our early gigs was a party that he had at a place he was living in the Detroit area. And we'd known him for years and years. But one thing that happened, too, on my part is I moved down to the southwest side of Detroit, and one day I was driving down the street, and I see Peggy and Dan walking down the street. And I was like, what the hell? Like, when they got flooded out of New Orleans from the hurricane, they moved to Detroit, and they ended up living in the same neighborhood.
Right, like right
like
pretty much
a
around
block,
the corner.
Yeah, away. So I thought, this must be a sign that it's time to renew our friendship, because I don't know how we could have ended up living within a block of each other suddenly.
Auguries? You're telling me this all comes down to auguries?
Yeah.
Yeah, and I kind of didn't want to. I was suspicious. I was suspicious of Dan. I was like, why does he keep calling me? I don't know what's going on.
Ulterior
Something must be
motives.
Desperately wrong. Like, what is... But that then, you know, I got over that and we started hanging out more.
Yeah, yeah, it was a strange combination of...
And then I got a phone call, and then that's all I remember about it. My ridiculous demand has never been met, but I said yes anyway.
You going to tell us what the demand was?
No.
All right.
It was ridiculous. But one day someone will give it to me.
Yeah.
Someday soon. You never know. Maybe here in Los Angeles.
Keep dreaming, baby.
One of the things in talking about when you guys originally got together, I think it was an interview that I was watching or reading with Mick, was talking about just the fact that Detroit in general, and it seems like for the most part still to this day, there wasn't much else going on. And that's one of the things I always wondered, kind of being somebody, I'm originally from the South, from Atlanta, and you just kind of hear, it seems like every generation there is this amazing movement coming out of Detroit and in some way or another.
Something.
There's always some great music coming out of Detroit. And we always wondered, you know, what was in the water to produce the Stooges and MC5, Motown before that, Funkadelic, you guys, another generation later, the White Stripes. And it just seemed it seemed almost too simple that it was just boredom that kind of pushed you towards to getting this together. But I mean, how did you guys originally get together as the Gorries?
We were bored.
It literally was just that.
Yeah, we were bored one night.
Yeah, you know, and we
sit around playing some records and thought, well, you know.
Well, I mean, we're really into music. I mean,
yeah,
that doesn't help.
I think we had an idea, like, a lot of the stuff we were hearing wasn't really doing it for us.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we had the idea that we should just do it ourselves and make some kind of music that really turns us on, that we really like.
What kind of music scene was there in Detroit around that time?
There's always a music
scene.
There's
everything.
There. Yeah,
anything.
Everything okay.
There's really good.
On.
There's a couple of great rockabilly bands. There was like metal, you know,
yeah,
hair metal.
Metal
hardcore.
Bands.
Metal.
Hardcore.
It's a hardcore in the 80s.
Jazz bands everywhere.
Jazz. Yeah. Blues. There's
still plenty
in
of blues
80s,
clubs.
There's still old time blues guys in Detroit.
There's always something going on somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there definitely wasn't anyone that quite sounded like you guys with this really raw. I guess that, you know, some of the records I would imagine you were running around before you put the band together were like these raw R&B records or kind of raw rockabilly records.
Well, mostly chess blues.
Hmm. That too, yeah.
Yeah, there was
a lot of stuff.
Know,
I mean,
Willie
a lot
Dixon
of
Dixon and you know, and all the
a lot of Bo Diddley, I would imagine.
A lot of Bo Diddley, yeah.
Muddy Waters and just all the
60s beat music.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, Back from the Grave and Scum of the Earth and that kind of all those kind of comps.
Like almost unlistenably lo-fi and barely talented bands, you know, it was kind of a, you know, there wasn't, you can't really say it was any sort of aesthetic. It was like, well, these bands are about this are at about the same talent level we are, so we can be at least as good as this.
Yeah.
And we were really enjoying that.
Yeah.
Music.
Yeah, we really liked it. We liked
that
stuff. It's like being a bad movie buff sort of thing, except it was music.
Yeah.
But Detroit's also a gold mine of records, too, you know. I mean, it's being mined more and more, but back then.
Yeah, a guy that I've kind of gotten to know almost last year, came out from Detroit into Los Angeles. He's a record dealer and just brings in these amazing records from Detroit.
Well, another thing about Detroit, too, is, like, so many people from the South moved up there, you know.
And it's a really, really big city. Also, you know, I mean, it's quite large, very spread out. I mean, there's a lot of stuff going on there.
But we had a melting pot of, like, people from Mississippi and Alabama and Georgia and Kentucky and Tennessee, Louisiana, in the case of Mick's parents, that moved up to Detroit to work in the auto industry. So all this amazing music and traditional music from down there, all these people funneled into Detroit, as with Chicago as well. But even in Detroit, like, there's a big hillbilly and rockabilly scene, too, as well as the soul and R&B and blues stuff. And really an incredible, melting pot of music from the South ended up there and sort of fermented into its own kind of thing, you know, where all those people wouldn't have ended up in one place otherwise if it wasn't for the auto industry, you know.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's probably, and it seems like that's also kind of the link that, especially in music, you know, post-60s into the 70s and 80s and current time, seems to link everybody's kind of the demise of that auto industry. And kind of maybe feeding boredom.
Motown is an almost direct result of the auto industry,
mm-hmm.
and Detroit techno is an almost direct result of the lack of an auto industry.
Mm-hmm.
You know, almost ironically, everybody talks about how mechanical techno music is, and you know, the part of the demise of the auto industry was the rise of robotics.
Yeah.
That's interesting. I never thought of that.
I don't know that there's an answer for that question, personally.
Yeah. Something that kind of sparked my mind when you guys were talking about that, and just this idea. I think a lot of times, especially when people aren't around when a band is currently playing shows and currently recording, that kind of like a mystique or a kind of myth kind of builds up around them. And it seems like there was like this real kind of Gory's aesthetic. But hearing you guys talk about it, it doesn't seem like this was like a conscious effort. It was just kind of three friends coming together.
All we wanted to do was be a raw band and be like really primitive because...
Yeah, I mean, there was an aesthetic in the sense that, yeah, we wanted to be primitive.
Yeah,
we wanted to be raw.
Exactly.
You know, we wanted to be visceral and simple.
We wanted to keep it as simple as possible.
We didn't have too much of a choice.
But we didn't have a choice.
Yeah, exactly.
That's true. You know, we
didn't know how to play really after all.
And I think we realized that we didn't really know how to play that well.
Well, I remember
a
long time ago talking,
knowing how to play
into
the band's aesthetic,
like a beat band, and we trying to do it and not really quite succeeding, and
yeah, I think
trying to cover some certain songs, and you know, not all of them really worked, and so it started. You know, the more we did that, the more we realized we had our own sound.
And also, by necessity, we had to break the songs down into their most basic components.
Yeah. Which for us was 9 notes. A song couldn't have more than 9 notes or it was too complicated to play.
Wow.
So all of our songs, if you listen to just about every song on the first Gory's album, every song has like around 6 notes in it total. Like 6 actual notes to play.
But yeah, you know, we started
noticing. That was our real limit.
That, like, Bo Diddley made some really super great one chord songs.
Yeah.
You know? And Howlin' Wolf, like, what is it?
What, Smokestack of Lightning?
Yeah, that's a one chord song.
Yeah.
What's the one? Tell Automatic Son.
Wang Dang Doodle.
Wang Dang Doodle's one chord.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
3 notes, 1 chord.
So we just kind of realized that, and we're like, well,
if these guys can make these great songs with Boogie Chillin literally is one note.
Yeah, it's just that one note.
If these guys can make these amazing tracks with like 1, 2, 3 notes, then perhaps we can do it too. Of course, you know, we at the time didn't realize that they were twice our age. So they had plenty of time learning how to write real songs and then stripping it down to 3 notes, whereas we didn't know any of that.
And we also started to notice that, like, there was a lot of Bo Diddley songs that didn't have a bass. It was just percussion. There wasn't even any cymbals.
Right.
It was just tom-toms, total jungle beat, you know, and
just that guitar.
Yeah, and like Johnny Hooker, all he did was stomp his foot and play guitar. And thought, you know, you don't need a bass, you don't need cymbals, you don't need all that stuff if you don't want to have it, you know.
Yeah, and I can't imagine what
Or if you can't play it.
Or if you can't play it, then, you know.
I can't imagine what the response would have been from a lot of people around that time.
Mostly it was indifference.
Nick used to call it the grass eater look. Where they're just this blank face like, huh?
I totally forgot about that.
You know?
Yeah, we just got stared at.
Mm-hmm.
Like people either just couldn't believe that, you know, a band would get up on stage and do what we did. That's the way it seemed to me. Like they were just like, why? Why didn't you guys just take another year or two and learn how to play?
Yeah, because we did do some shows that were pretty unbearably out of tune, even for me.
You know, people would be like, well, why don't you have a bass and that sort of thing?
I think a lot of people, you know, I remember friends of ours saying, you know, you guys suck.
Yeah,
people used to tell us to our face.
It's like, man, you guys suck.
But we would just have to stand there and take it. But we also
know.
Had friends that understood what, you know, I think that understood what we were trying to do.
Uh-huh.
But I think the funnest reactions were just from, you know, people that we didn't really know that were happened to be hanging out in the bars that we were playing. Like the one time at Paychex, there was this one guy that said, if anyone survives a nuclear explosion, you will. I don't really know what that means, but, you know.
That's such a brilliant quote, though.
This other guy back, this must have been like maybe 1988 or something, said, you guys are the monks of the 80s.
And we didn't know who they were.
We didn't even know who
the
monks were at that point. They hadn't even reissued that album.
Yeah, we had no idea what he was talking about.
Yeah.
And even when we heard it, we were like, nah, these guys are way better than we are.
So that first record, you guys are pretty much on your own putting it together, that house rocking record. But somehow you hooked up with Alex Chilton. How did that happen?
I'll tell her future husband, Dan, who we've been referring to all night.
Yeah, we were talking about.
He introduced Alex Chilton to us by way of playing at a party. They were at a party, and he, like, trapped him somehow. I thought he was at
George Reinecke's, or not Reinecke, George Hadjidakis' house in Tuscaloosa, and Alex was there, and he played him something. Maybe it was.
Yeah, but I think as Dan tells it, he didn't say to Alex, "Hey, I want you to hear."
Yeah, he just put this record on.
Yeah, he put it. Just put it on.
He just put it on and let him. And yeah. Alex did react, and he said, "Hey, who is that?" You know. And Dan said, "Well, by the way, that's actually some friends of mine." And you know, and Alex was like, "Wow, this is really good." And I guess Alex was like, "You know, if you know them," he goes, "you should get them in touch with me because I think that I could help them out." Alex at that time was on New Rose Records out in France, and he was like, "You know, I'd really like to produce a record on those guys."
He was steering bands their way.
Yeah, put it on New Rose, and I think they would probably do well in Europe and that sort of thing. And so Dan gave Alex my phone number, I think, and Alex called me. And the first thing he asked me is, "Who's your drummer?"
It's just that raw sound.
Yeah. You know, and he said, "Yeah, you know, he explained the whole thing to me. I work with this label, New Rose, and I'd like to produce this album for you guys. I think it'd go over well and this and that." And so we ended up going down to Memphis and recording. Stayed at Falco's house.
That was fun for like a month. Didn't we?
Then we pulled up to
like a month.
We pulled up to Taff Falco's house, and Lorette Velvet was climbing out of the window as we
pulled
up.
And Misty White was with her.
No, she didn't. We were sitting there, and she just pulls up. She pulls up in the car, and it's like she says, "Hey, how y'all doing?" And then she breaks the window and climbs in and opens the door. We're looking at her like,
"Yeah, what is going on here?" She's climbing out of this window of this
house.
And
Misty says, "I know this looks bad. We're not. Don't. You know." I'm Misty. I know this looks bad, but really, we're just getting
it's all right.
That
don't
stuff
call
out
the
of
cop.
There.
Yeah, they had just broken up is what happened. Yeah. She broke in to get some of her belongings.
I just remember Lorette with one leg in one on the porch.
Yeah.
We should have taken a
Making
picture
small talk.
y'all the glories, huh?
Hey, y'all. Nice to meet you.
That was our introduction to Memphis.
Right? Yeah, that doesn't have anything to do with the story behind like a song like Nitroglycerin, does it?
No. Most of the songs are me and Dan sitting in the living room going, "We need a song."
Yeah, right.
Yeah, that was something I was always wondering, just like what that whole process was of getting that songs together for the group. Because again, it had that kind of. Coming into, I guess I heard the Gories when I was in college. So this was This is in the mid-90s. So it was a little after you guys had broken up when I first heard it on a show in Atlanta. It was done by a couple of friends called the Outer Limits with Brian and Christy Montero, and they played a lot of music that was just kind of underground music you never heard anywhere else, and play like you guys and the 5678s and like a lot of those kind of bands at that time. You just didn't hear that music anywhere else, and I always wondered just where you get the inspiration for a song like Nitroglycerin or a Thunderbird ESQ, you know.
Well,
like
I remember specifically what song Nitroglycerin was kind of
drawn from. We heard a song and then we thought, man, we got to get a song like that. And so we just kind of like robbed him. I'm not going to say what the song is, but we heard a song and thought, man, we got to get a song that sounds like this right here.
Well, Mick's philosophy was always, why cover a song when you can write one that sounds like it? Mm-hmm. Which sounds really simple, but it's not always.
It's not as easy.
It's not as easy, I don't think.
But that was one of those instances.
Yeah.
Like a corner.
I actually only remember one actual songwriting session that Dan and I had when we were working on the third album, where we sat down and said, we have to come up with some songs, because Out of Here happened after we had broken up,
mm-hmm.
and we got the offer to play, to go tour Europe with Crip Records if we cut an album. And Dan and I thought, well, we haven't played, we haven't talked to each other in 6 months. How are we going to cut an album? so, you know,
you came over to my house.
Yeah, I lived around the block from him at this point, and so I came over and we sat down, and the first thing we wrote was "He's Doing It." And what we like had, that was the only time I really remember us sitting down thinking, we have to come up with some songs.
Right.
Usually they would just sort of happen. He would have an idea, or I would have an idea, or we'd both have ideas, just sort of put them, or I would, or one of us would write the entire song and just like present it. Say, here's a song I wrote. But that was the only time where we had to do it, like where we like actually did it as a 9-to-5 kind of thing, where we sat down and wrote songs. That usually never happened that way. Not to my memory anyway.
Yeah. But I do remember. We were like, okay, we got to come up with some stuff.
We were watching your girlfriend's crazy cat hang on the drapes.
Yeah.
And that's how we wrote
hump,
"He's Doing It."
A hump a stuffed toy.
Yeah.
There's some inspiration for you.
That was one crazy ass cat, man.
So it seems kind of interesting to me, you know, you were talking about how when you guys were first coming up and the shows that you were playing when you were originally together, people had a lot of this kind of grass-fed look on their face that didn't quite know what to do with you. And I thought I had also read somewhere else, you know, a lot of the shows you guys did when you were together first time around, you know, not huge crowds, weren't big places, but I would imagine some of that has changed a little bit with these reunion shows.
Yeah, it's gotten a little
Well, even, you know, what, like in 92, like the year that we were breaking up and falling apart, people that we
time.
Didn't this know one. Had
yeah,
just yeah, had just
for,
started to come to our shows.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we would do a show in Detroit and suddenly 75 people would show up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And we were like, what's going on here? Who are these people?
Yeah.
You know, there's suddenly a little, after beating our heads against the wall for 7 years around Detroit,
suddenly
there was some
were
kind
coming
of
out.
Buzz.
Yeah.
You know.
I remember the last
and,
time we
yeah,
went to New York.
About that.
Yeah.
You're right.
Yeah.
That's weird.
And like, there's a guy from Warner Brothers that contacted us about doing demos.
Yeah. After we'd broken up.
Yeah. You know, it was like suddenly when we were finally burned out.
Yeah. When we finally had enough of
playing
the, of
for
playing
7 years.
For nobody together. Playing for beer. You know, and people telling us we stank and, you know, everything. After all that, finally, people, we were finally fed up with it. And then people were interested.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But we were totally burned out by that point.
Yeah,
we
didn't
go
care.
On. We just couldn't go
yeah,
on.
Yeah, yeah. It's just over.
What's the thing, you know, sitting here in the room with you guys right now, it seems like you all, you know, a lot of times the reunion show bands, they're like some particular reasons why people get together. For you guys, it seems like it was, you know, it's just kind of happenstance that, you know, you got back together and
well,
enjoy playing with each other for the most part, and
there's a
kind
of
still doing
water under very many bridges.
Yeah,
yeah. I mean, it took a long time to get to
this
point.
Let's put it
yeah,
that way.
It didn't happen overnight.
But you know, on the other hand, we definitely didn't want to do this just for money or just for whatever. I mean, we really wanted to be able to put our hearts and souls into it. And, you know, we didn't want to be some crappy reunion that
yeah.
sucked and had no soul to it. And, you know, and we also don't want to beat ourselves to death doing this either.
Like, yeah.
You know, we're going
to. My part's over.
Yeah. We'll call
yeah,
it.
We can't ever do that again. Mm-hmm. Be a big mistake.
Yeah.
So we'll, you know, call it quits when, you know, we think that it's.
Yeah. This is a finite thing, I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
There'll be a point where we, you know, we just feel that we've done everything we ever wanted
I mean,
to do with
yeah.
it.
I mean, we have shows through November.
Yeah.
And
then
yeah.
after
that,
that,
I mean,
who
I'm
knows?
Ready
it could
not
be anything.
To do it for
yeah.
a
yeah.
yeah.
It's
yeah.
also why we elected to not do any recording either, because both Dan and I felt that we've said everything we had ever planned to say with the Gorries.
Yeah.
And there's just nothing left for it for us. We yeah. talked about it a few times now, but it's like, no, just, no.
Yeah, it's, you know, that's kind of the sense I got, you know, this, because you guys are all involved in groups and kind of have, you know, these new ways of getting out your music over the last several years. You know, to me, it's like another band that I kind of revere from earlier that period, but from the UK, Crass, like had this super aesthetic and had like planned the time they were going to break up, and for like them to get back together and record almost would kind of like mess with
the whole
idea. Yeah. You know? And so like for me as a fan and someone who appreciates your music and just the way that it came out the box to begin with and hearing it on records, you know, I appreciate that because it just seems like, you know, it was kind of one of those things where it ended up working out at the right time to come together and to play, and the right reasons are there. And it's this moment where, you know, I would imagine there's so many people, you know, kind of like me, just never had the chance. Either wouldn't have heard the records originally.
Right. I don't want to sound unsympathetic about that. Because I know I sounded a bit unsympathetic earlier about it, but, you know, I mean, there was really nothing we could do about it. Yeah. We'd broken up.
Yeah.
You never got a chance to see us. Well, sorry, man. But now, you know, now you got your chance.
Yeah.
You better take it now. Yeah. Everybody out there listening who was around in 88 or whatever and didn't see us, go to the shows now.
Yeah.
Or who's discovered us since.
Yeah, you know, we weren't alive. There's a few folks out there who weren't even alive when we were making records, so.
How do you guys feel about the legacy of the Gorries?
Somebody else better answer
that.
I think
we all respect it.
Yeah.
You know, the songs still have legs. They're still I personally still enjoy playing them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, they're still good songs. I respect what we did. I respect
Yeah,
the
I
songs.
Think the recordings, you know, yeah. have always stood up. I'm going to tell a story here. After we had been broken up for a long time, I was reading a review about some band that I can't even remember now, and they compared it to the first Gorries album. And it had been like 6 or so years, and I never play my own records anyway. Like once it's recorded, I stop thinking about it and start working on the next one. But I hadn't heard the record in about 6 or 7 years, and just out of curiosity, I thought, I wonder, you know, does the first Gorries record even stand up to records that are being made now? And I put it on, and for the first time, I heard it the way everybody else heard it, you know, who wasn't there. And I thought, man, this is crazy. If I hadn't made this, I wouldn't have believed it existed.
Well, I remember when we were in Memphis last summer and we put on the second album to kind of relearn the songs, you know, and you were listening to it and you're going, man, this is pretty good.
Yeah.
And I got the feeling that you hadn't even listened to it
no.
in like many years.
No.
I have periodically.
Nah, I never play my own records and the gory stuff. I hadn't listened to it in almost a decade.
But I know, like, for instance, like, Peg, I know it was really important to you in particular that we didn't suck and that we played the songs the way that we always did and we didn't try to change anything. And I think we all agree
on
that.
I don't see any reason to change it.
Well, yeah, I definitely
could,
didn't
want to
suck. I just think it's easy to do if you haven't played together in, you know, many, many years. And I've personally seen a lot of reunion bands be bad.
Yeah.
And I just, I was like, I don't want to do it if it's going to be that way. So, got to start practicing.
So, I think we respect our legacy and we want to present it in a way that we want to present the Gorries that people remember and we want it to be like it.
And for people out here who never saw us, to be as close to what you would have seen in 1988 as possible for us to deliver.
Yeah.
Man. I'm not wearing a suit.
Yeah, there's a few things that have changed, but not many.
The suit is gone. Someone stole the suit.
Yeah. But it's funny because not like for all three of us.
Someone stole that suit?
Yeah, someone took it out of the van after our last New York show. Someone stole it out of the van. But I know where it is now.
Well, it was pretty ripped up.
Yeah, I know where it is now, too. Yeah.
Who has it?
Guess.
Come on. I'll give you...
We'll talk about that later.
So anyway, but
someone has my drum set out there somewhere too. I heard someone in Detroit had it. They took it out of the trash after I threw it away.
Oh, I know who that is.
We can talk about that later too.
Oh, so many stories yet to be told.
Did Detroit's like that, man.
Yeah.
Yeah, Peggy threw a drum kit in the dumpster.
Yeah.
I found a 61 Showman in the trash in Detroit, so.
In disgust.
Well, you know, I can speak for a lot of people. We're really happy to have you guys, you know, back together and playing shows. And, you know, a lot of people are really thankful for that, especially the way you're doing it. And, you know, because to me, a lot of great bands played over the years. There are only really a handful of bands, I think, that whose music really kind of just like hits you in a way that it makes you want to either just get up and do something or start a band, you know. Mm-hmm. And to me, you guys are in that same kind of handful of, like, a lot of people talk about the Velvet Underground that same way, that everybody who listened to it started a band.
Right.
Like, to me, I know personally so many bands that listen to the Gorys and either more or less became Gorys tribute bands or kind of took that kind of sound, especially in Atlanta. And, you know, we're just nice to have you here, and especially here in the studio, chat with us. I really do appreciate it.
Woo. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Thank you. Hello, so there you go. There's an interview with the Gorys, recorded here at KPFK a little earlier in the afternoon. They're performing later on tonight at Spaceland, later on tonight performing with Haunted George, and also performing at the Echo with Haunted George and Nice Smile on Wednesday, September 8th. I have tickets for that show on September 8th. I got 4 pairs of tickets. If you want to go and see the legendary Gorys along with Haunted George and Nice Smile over at the Echo on Wednesday, September the 8th, give me a call at 818-985-5735-818-985. KPFK is the number. Gonna play you maybe my favorite song from the Gorys, Thunderbird ESQ, here on KPFK's Melting Pot.
I'm going out, gonna get my girl, gonna go to the store, buy some Thunderbird. Gonna get in my car, find some place to be alone. And we're gonna start drinking till it's all gone. For Thunderbird, yes, you. Say, baby, what's wrong with you? You look like you drank too much ESQ. I took her home, left her laying by the door. Got back in my car and drank some more. 2, 3, 4.